Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Friday edition of The Realignment. These Friday episodes are brought to you by our Supercast subscribers who have gifted us the ability to increase our production and build the best show possible. If you support our mission or want to get access to our Ask Me Anything Q&A function or other community building aspects we're deploying over the next few months, we'd love for you to go to realignment.supercast.com and offer us $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. Deeply appreciate the support that we get to help build this into the best independent podcast we can. On to today's episode. Back in March, I began recording 30 days straight of episodes in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. My first guest was Nate Sibley, who studies kleptocracy at the Hudson Institute. If you haven't gotten the chance, be sure to go back and listen to that episode. It came out on March 2nd. We discussed the impact of the massive sanctions package placed on Russia in response to the war. This obviously has impact on both how foreign policy would be conducted in the 21st century, but how a possible sanctions response would determine, or at least deter, Chinese aggression in the Asia Pacific, specifically towards Taiwan. Now, there's been a lot of debate on this topic, and listeners have requested that we follow up on that Nate Sibley episode, because there's been a lot of debate about whether or not the sanctions package has been effective or not. One side of that debate is represented by a new paper. It's called Business Retreats and Sanctions Are Crippling the Russian Economy. It's out of Yale University, led by Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. The report details that the sanctions package has had three main effects. One, Russia's imports have collapsed. Two, Russian domestic production has come to a complete standstill. And three, foreign companies that have left Russia account for 40% of the country's GDP, and none of them are coming back anytime soon. This leads the group to conclude, quote, looking ahead, there is no path out of economic oblivion for Russia as long as the allied countries remain unified in maintaining and increasing sanctions pressure. I had the pleasure of speaking to two members of the group that wrote and co-authored the paper, Viktor Babinski and Franek Sokolowski. This is a really interesting conversation. I will note that I will do a follow-up conversation at some point in the next few months discussing the other side, arguing that the sanctions practice has not been effective and how that could possibly also impact future conflicts such as one with China. All that said, this is a great episode and hope you all enjoy it. I'm sure Sagar and I will discuss this report and its findings in a follow-up discussion episode maybe next week. All that said, thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. Franek and Viktor, welcome to The Realignment.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to be here.
I'm really excited to speak to the both of you. It's kind of hard to do the panel podcast. So basically the best way to do this is I'll just switch off asking one of you the questions first. Feel free to follow up and go and take it wherever you want to go, because the paper that y'all have put out is so interesting and there's so many different places to go. So let's just start off by introducing the two of yourselves for the audience. Franek, let's start with you, and Viktor, you could go in. What's your background? What drew you to this topic of sanctions, Russia policy, all those different bits?
So my name is Franek Sokołowski, and I'm a Polish student at Yale, majoring in history and economics, most likely. And I've been always interested in Eastern Europe because I was brought up there. So after the war erupted, after the initial, after I was horrified for a bit, I took some action. So we were working with this esteemed American professor, Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, and we participated in several projects related to the invasion of Russia and specifically the business response and economic response to the invasion of Ukraine.
Great. How about you, Viktor?
My name is Viktor Babinski. I'm also Polish, and I'm a graduate student at Yale, writing a dissertation in history about NATO expansion in Eastern Europe, Eastern Central Europe. So, obviously Eastern Europe and the issues of the post-Soviet and post-communist sphere are very close to my heart. And like Franek, I was raised very close to where all the action is happening. My hometown is just a few miles away from the famous Suwalki corridor, where Belarus nearly borders the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. So these issues have always been on my mind. And like Franek, when the war started, at first I shook off this horrible feeling that we're there in the East Coast and we can't do anything. And we got on to work with Professor Sonnenfeld, who's the main author of the piece we'll be discussing. And we're trying to make our little contribution while also dealing with issues that interest us a lot.
It's really interesting to hear the two of your Eastern European backgrounds, because as I'm recording this on Zoom, I see Babinski, I see Sokolovsky. My last name is Kozlov. I'm adopted into a Ukrainian Jewish family. So there's 15 different levels that we could get into in a different podcast there, but this is a very Eastern European centric background for this episode, obviously. So with that in mind, let's just start by going into the paper that the two of you both helped write and contributed to, really focusing on the effects of the sanctions policy, but also the retreat of foreign businesses from Russia. So let's just start by breaking down those two dynamics, because they're related, but they're also separate. So starting with the sanctions, like, how should we conceive of the sanctions policies? Like, what are they specifically? Either of you could answer this first and then just go back and forth on that.
So maybe I'll start. I think it is a pretty unusual sanctions regime we have here, because usually in the past, the sanctions were much more spotty. They didn't concern as large country as Russia, which is $1.5 trillion. It's still as large as Italy, so it is not a big behemoth. We should remember that. However, we also, these sanctions regimes didn't also concern a country which was so internationally involved. I can think of no other country outside of the, you know, of the core West, the elites of which have spent the last two decades buying up illiquid assets in the West, as the Russian elites have in France, in London. So some unprecedented moves undertaken within the new sanctions regime, such as freezing of the Russian assets over $100 billion, freezing of Russian foreign exchange reserves, they were possible because of the degree of interlinkage between Russian economy and the global economy, which is quite unprecedented.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering, I'll go into a bit of history here, but very recent history, that Russia has been penetrating Western markets, and not property markets, but also financial markets in quite illicit ways for the last two decades. I can make a reading recommendation here. Catherine Belton has written a wonderful book about it a few years ago called Putin's People, where she details all the amounts of illicit money. According to different analysis, it's about a few hundred billion US dollars that poured into Western Europe and the United States of America illicitly through different business schemes involving mostly natural resources, then siphoning this cash off into real estate, into different slush funds around the West that can be later used to fund Russian influence operations in the West. So the sanctions regime also strikes at Russia's slush fund of illicit money for active measures that has been created in the West. And this consciousness of the danger that the fact that the West hosts a lot of Russian money makes to our political systems has only been really up in the air very recently, since 2017. When the issue of Russian influence in US and British elections and referenda has been brought to light. So thanks to this amazing outpouring of determination in light of the war, the West has been able for the first time to muster a serious response to what has been for the last two decades a creeping influence operation conducted through large amounts of cash that Russia has been doing here.
So the next bit then would be the actual retreats of foreign businesses. Could you all describe how that process went about? Because it's complicated. There's a mix of oftentimes complying with the sanctions regime required businesses to leave Russia, but you also have businesses that for pure, almost soft power reasons have said, look, like we don't want to be perceived as doing business in Russia during the course of this war. So describe both what's happened with the companies, but then also the economic effects on Russia of that pullback.
Maybe because before I jump into it, I have to make two disclaimers I forgot about. First of all, I'm a fan of the podcast, believe it or not. I've listened to, I think, 10 to 15 episodes, and you are doing great work. And second of all, the fact that there are so many Polish people in the team isn't tied to any kind of anti-Russian sentiment, but Professor Sonnenfeld was simply looking for Russian speakers and also for people who are able to work double shifts, essentially, because we have 53 people in the team, because there's so much data to comb through and 1,000 companies and business exits to grade. So when one part of the team is falling asleep, the other one is waking up. So we have a 24/7 operation here. And Victor also got some firsthand experience on Russia because he traveled via the Trans-Siberian Railroad back in 2018. So that's on our side. But when it comes to the business boycott, we were actually witness of that very boycott firsthand, because Professor Sonnenfeld, who's been an advocate of corporate social responsibility for the last four decades, he's 68 now, and he's been doing the same thing since the 1970s, essentially, first at Harvard, then at Emory, now at Yale for two decades. Professor Sonnenfeld has been saying that, I think, ever since 2014, actually, since the annexation of Crimea, that we should not do business with authoritarian countries, not only because of the moral reasons, but also because of the long-term financial performance of the company. And for all the people who said, oh, you are so Russophobic, you should not complain about our new great project with Russia, their businesses are actually now in peril, in danger. Because when you don't have rule of law, when you are, you know, you can disappear at the whim of the ruler, as we clearly see now, it is not a good business environment. And when it comes to the business boycotts, our thesis is that the moral evil of the Russian aggression was so clear here. We had this very clear David versus Goliath story, that it was very hard for the businesses to say, oh, this is a more complex issue. There are a couple of sides. Ukraine didn't want to be invaded. Ukraine didn't commit these mass atrocities. So after facing this very clear pressure, the businesses also pressured by both the stakeholders in the academia, in the media, and also their young workforce, decided to quit. And once the momentum started, which was catalyzed by the list produced by Professor Sonnenfeld, which became the central repository of which company is doing what, and it actually served as a motivational device for the companies to see, oh, my competitor did that. Okay, BP is selling its Russian stake in Rosneft for 10 billion. I mean, they're writing it off. And whenever someone was complaining to us, like, oh, this will cost our business, we can point to BP's example, because they really took a hit.
Although this reaction hasn't been uniform across all the countries we've analyzed, while we were analyzing the data, we subdivided it into different countries in which the companies originate. And to make it easier, divided all those different categories that we've given to the companies into colors. And if you zoomed into Poland, for example, or any other European country east of Berlin, say, you could see that all those companies basically on the list were green, which indicates the highest level of withdrawal in our methodology. But if you moved a bit west, like to France or Italy, These numbers started getting a little bit patchy, although still overwhelmingly green. But if you moved somewhere else, far away from Europe, like India or China, the image reversed itself. You would see most of the lists in the color red, which indicates the highest level of non-withdrawal. And that proves clearly with hard indisputable data that the issue of withdrawal and of sanctions and of this consumer demand for companies to behave responsibly in the international sphere is tied to politics and to local perceptions of the conflict. Because clearly these are different in Eastern Europe, a bit different maybe in Western Europe, although increasingly similar, but much different in other regions of the world.
What are y'all's concerns about the business pullout? So the way I articulate this is, once businesses started to pull out and there was a clear effect on the Russian economy, a pushback you started to see was, wait, this could be a bad thing in the sense that all these companies are making these hasty moves. Hypothetically, you would want to have some sort of deal on the table for Russia maybe. So, hey, if you pull out of Ukraine, you could get your economic GDP back, all those different bits, but the companies are acting unilaterally and having so much of an impact on the actual conflict and Russia's perception of it. How do you all think through like that bit of the dynamic, basically companies as independent actors that are playing such a large role in the geopolitics and the geoeconomics here?
Well, companies are market institutions, you could say. So obviously they should, in a healthy market economy, respond to market pressures and to the pressures of its consumers. And I think that's, I think we all believe that that's better than the alternative of imposing some coordinated top-down scheme or framework of withdrawals and maybe offers to Russia that if they modify their behavior, companies will start coming back. That's probably feasible. We have to ask ourselves the question, do we really want to live in a world, in a country, in an economy where the state or some top-down authority dictates that to companies? Of course, withdrawal from Russia is very desirable and essential. But our work and I think our desire is that these companies should respond to market pressures and to the moral desires of its consumers, because the alternative is leads us into a direction away from market economy and from economic freedom and from the type of society that the West endorses and that we fight for in this war.
And maybe I will just quickly add that, in my view, so much expertise was exported from the governments to the private sector, especially since the 80s, since the end of the Cold War, as the neoliberal paradigm started to be the dominant one, that companies can no longer say, oh, we aren't that important. These companies are extremely important because they have the expertise. They hire all the most talented graduates of the best universities in most Western countries. So they are essentially extensions of state capacity, especially the largest companies, the largest financial companies, the largest technological companies. For instance, even governments are hiring McKinsey just to have access to this brain power, because many of these people do not want to work for the governments directly. That's why they are so important.
So what we're doing at Yale here is we're taking the long road to the desirable goal. Of course, sanctions are important and some forcible measures, which we'll discuss in a moment, are important. But we're working on creating creating voluntary social responsibility in our companies. As companies, private business, as Franek rightly pointed out, assumes more and more power in our social economic systems, we wanted to assume voluntarily more responsibility. We want to do it through voluntary measures. It's hard work, of course, and sometimes a degree of making stuff public for the consumer to see is necessary. But I think that we think this long road is better to the alternative.
So here, I was going to ask this a little later in the script, but I'll ask it here now. How are you and companies thinking about China risk then? Because I like your point at the start of the episode where, you know, the professor's been talking about this issue and the vulnerabilities of Russian entanglement since 2014 for like a longer time period. And you could even see in 15, 16, 17, 18, that there was actual risk of entangling yourself in the Russian economy. Now, a bunch of companies obviously didn't act on that. But now that we've seen what's happened with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, how are you all thinking about how companies should think about risk entangling themselves in the Chinese economy, given both the mix of just like internal CCP policies, but also just maybe there's a potential invasion of Taiwan. Maybe there's increasing crackdowns on Hong Kong. How are you thinking about that next stage of this bit?
Yeah, so this is, of course, not the direct focus of our group, our working group. So I can just speculate on a personal basis. I think I'll start with an anecdote. Our common friend whom we met at Yale, who talks to many government officials, not only from the United States, told us that in the course of the war, Americans were criticizing their European counterparts, asking, how on earth could you have gotten so dependent on a country, economically speaking, on a country with which you may in the future have some geopolitical tensions? And fair point, of course. And the Polish government and Central Europeans in general have been pointing that out for decades, and nobody listens to it. But then the Europeans say, oh, yes. And what about the American dependency on China, or what Neil Ferguson called Chimerica, this economic ecosystem that has bound the United States and Chinese economies together to a very large extent? And there is no obvious answer to that. We haven't been researching that, and perhaps one day this question should be explored. But so far, we're trying to focus on Russia. And obviously, this is an extremely important question that both the U.S. business needs to ask for itself, but also the American government. Because as we've seen recently with Taiwan and with the trip of Speaker Pelosi, these tensions in Southeast Asia aren't going anywhere, even though we're focused on Eastern Europe now.
Yes, and I can probably very quickly just add that I just said about the role of the direct military conflict as being so important to crystallizing these a lot of things that could have been, you know, swept under the rug, was it not for these images. So China wasn't involved in a direct military conflict, I think, since the 1970s. So that's why I think this issue, the economic scale is way larger. Their economy is perhaps 15 times larger, maybe even greater in the PPP, purchasing power parity. However, since we don't have this direct confrontation, it takes a back bench a little bit.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. So one last thing before we get into the specifics of what y'all's research demonstrated, a key thing is that the sanctions package excluded oil and natural gas. So a very obvious argument from the start on the Russian side has been that these sanctions haven't impacted us. We're doing better than ever because of the fact that they have obviously this massive cushion of their oil and gas reserves. And you've seen the price of energy really just spike there. So what is y'all's overall just response to the claim that the sanctions haven't been effective because of oil and gas prices?
I can certainly say that they could be more effective was it not for primarily Europe's dependence on Russian oil and Russian gas. However, they are still pretty effective. So not only was half of Russian foreign exchange reserves frozen in the Western countries, but what the remaining half that they have still access to is dwindling. I think they already run through 20% of it. And the interesting thing is that they tried to diversify away from the US after 2014. So they've been moving their foreign exchange reserves away from the US. But unfortunately for Russians, they moved those reserves to the Western countries, to Japan, a lot of them. So they still don't have access to it. So that's one part. And the other part is the Western countries haven't finished sanctioning Russia. We are at a temporary moment where some sanctions have been implemented. In Europe, there have been, I think, 7 packages of sanctions so far. And the general intention of everyone is to continue sanctioning Russia. And we have a couple of processes going at the same time. But essentially, Europe is rapidly diversifying away from Russia. Russia is much more dependent on Europe than Europe is on Russia. And had this war erupted before 2014, the situation would have been much worse for Europe. But some countries already started to diversify. For instance, Poland built these pipelines to Norway or these LNG liquefied natural gas terminals. Connectors were built between European countries. So Europe is essentially bracing for a much fuller, removal of Russian energy. There is a whole group on sanctions at Stanford called Yermak-McFaul Group on Sanctions, and they have a couple of interesting propositions, such as creating a escrow account for the proceeds from the Russian government. So you de facto force them and say that you will continue paying for these resources as much as you need them. Maybe you can decrease it, but you will pay to this escrow account and they can do nothing about it. So that there are a couple of ideas, and this will certainly be an issue over the next few months. Our family, will spend the winter in Europe. So there is obviously fear of the gas shortage, but all the available data points out to the fact that by now, because of the shale revolution in the US and the technological innovations and the European cooperation, the worst case scenario, there will be some rationing for industrial producers. So Germany will produce a little bit of manufacturing of products which require natural gas, or we'll have a couple of degrees Celsius lower heating in the winter, and maybe lose totally worst case 1-3% of GDP. But Ukrainian freedom will be protected, and these changes will stay permanently because this crisis forces Europe to make this very long delayed change. And after it is done, I cannot imagine anyone returning to Russia. And they are earning 60% of their GDP from fossil fuel exports, and they cannot switch these exports to China, especially of the gas. So
why can't they?
It's already bad, and it will only get worse. That's the main takeaway.
So quick thing, because this is talked about in the paper and it's very interesting. Why can't they just, and either you could answer this, why can't they just pivot their natural gas specifically to the Chinese market, which obviously is growing, expanding, all those different bits? Or why is that not easy?
Victor.
Okay, sure. Well, and before I do that, I just wanted to add that, after all, the United States has indeed banned imports of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal. That's of course a unilateral action by the US and wasn't followed up fully by the European Union for obvious reasons. But as Franek pointed out, Europe is moving away from Russian gas. And this, as historians often say, crisis is the best facilitator of progress. And in this case, this crisis will, in macro-historical terms, move Europe away from dependency on Russia. And going back to your question, Russia can't very easily redirect its energy exports because these require significant investments in infrastructure, and infrastructure is expensive and very cost and takes a lot of time to build. Less than 10% of Russia's gas capacity is LNG, which is easily transportable, which means that the remaining 90% needs a network of pipelines to be distributed. However, most of the Russian pipeline network is focused in Europe because traditionally that has been the main market, and the Russians haven't prepared to redirect their exports to Asia because they never believed that Europe would actually brace itself to wean itself off of their exports. Now, European pipelines, those pipelines that direct Russian gas to Europe have 10 times more capacity than the ones directing exports to Asia. Moreover, the European and Asian branches of the network are not interconnected. So to sell more gas to Asia, one needs to build a lot of infrastructure. And that is both expensive and takes a long time. So we doubt that Russia is capable of finishing this project, of constructing this project in ever really, but certainly not in a very short term. So this game that Russia is playing of threatening Europe with its vulnerability to Russian exports, it's not a game in which Russia has a very strong hand. Europe and probably has a better chance of diversifying its imports than Russia has of diversifying its exports in the short term.
And I like the way you put it, Victor, because if you think about it that way, the more pressure in the short term Russia puts on European countries, obviously that increases the incentive to diversify away from Russia in the medium to long term too. So you're kind of stuck in a cycle where this had to just be over very, very, very quickly in order to not allow there to be enough long-term pressure, but it obviously didn't go that way. A question that comes to mind, I'd love to hear from just the two of you. This is off script here. I want to hear what you two think about just this broad storyline of Europe and especially Eastern Europe. Like, I think we're of similar ages. We're obviously growing up in this post-Cold War moment. I'm sure if you were even just Eastern European, you're thinking of the 90s, the 2000s as this period where things are integrating, things are getting better. And obviously the two of you are very directly, not just from a research perspective, but obviously from a personal perspective, seeing that storyline literally just collapse in on itself. What's that just like? Like, personally and intellectually?
Maybe I'll start the personal part and Victor will continue the intellectual part. So our position was us being, you know, students in the US on financial aid was unimaginable 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. Also because no one thought of applying abroad. I have this family story that my grandma has this Yale sweatshirt she got in a food aid package in the 1980s when Poland was experiencing martial law and was crippled by the Western sanctions. So that's the personal aspect. The country has changed so much. And we've also worked with former president of Poland and Nobel laureate Lech Wałęsa, who led the anti-communist effort in Poland. So we also, you know, by proximity saw some of that, some of the residues of that history. And the longer I study the macro history, the more grateful I am for how the history has played out. I'm sure Victor can elaborate it, but essentially in Poland, we had this bloodless transition between communist dictatorship, little softer than in Soviet Union, and the capitalist liberal democracy. It was done via a roundtable agreement between the opposition and the government, with the support of the Catholic Church, which was never subdued. You always had, like, you know, 35 million of Poles out of 38 million were baptized as Catholics. So even in the worst Stalinist period, the government had to, you know, discuss with the church. They tried to imprison the main cardinal for 3 years, but the presence of church was very important. But since you didn't have, you had this, you know, rotten compromise, and the communist apparatchiks weren't really prosecuted for their crimes, a lot of Poles feel the resentment. And I felt it as a teenager, but the older I got, I could see the broader context and how transitions happen and how rarely they actually happen. So I think the understanding of the broader context is very important.
Well, for me, intellectually speaking, I think, I'll again start with an anecdote. I spoke recently to Konstanty Gebert, a famous Polish journalist, war correspondent, and intellectual, who said that having witnessed the 1990s, especially 1989 to 1991, one cannot help but to be an optimist, because that was a one in a million scenario. And that has been a prevalent feeling for the Poles in the last three decades, up until recently, that everything has worked out so well. But on the other hand, I have to say, for us in Central and Eastern Europe, history hasn't stopped in 1991, as many in America believed. Most of us, and of our policymakers as well, were never fully on board with the idea that Russia will now become this democracy, liberal economy, or even a partner of the West. Even when the West gave up around 2012 on the idea that Russia will become a democracy, but still hoped it would be a partner, we were skeptical of that. Because for us, history is still going on. We remember what Russia was in the 1800s and in the 1900s, and we haven't really seen this struggle, this geopolitical, cultural, social struggle ending. But to put it in an even broader perspective, I feel when I talk to Western intellectuals, policymakers, historians, for a lot of them, Russia has always been there, especially those that specialize in international relations. They treat Russia as this permanent fixture of Eurasia and cannot imagine a different future for Eurasia, for Eastern Europe, for the Caucasus, for Central Asia, without Russia as the stabilizing factor. And that's because international history is mostly taught since the French Revolution. And it so happens that right around the time of the French Revolution, the Russian Empire has entered the international arena as a great power, but it has not been one before. Before the late 1700s, Russia has been an isolated, resentful state in terms of both economic, political, and cultural. And other arrangements and ideas have governed regions like Central Europe or the Caucasus or Central Asia or even the Far East. And I think history teaches us that nothing is permanent ever, and that things change and one needs to be open to seeing a future different from what the last few hundred years have been. So if you look at the history of for example, Eastern Europe or Europe in general, in the broader thousand-year perspective, it is conceivable to imagine that Russian power is at its eclipse. And if it is, and we believe that this current war, both in economic and political terms, will shoot Russia back to the 1600s, you have to imagine a different future, a future in which something else fills the vacuum in all those crucial geopolitical regions of the globe, like Eastern Europe, like the Caucasus, like Central Asia. And then if we're, just to end this historical digression, we need to imagine a future where Russia is not the primary power in its region. Because whether we like it or not, we'll probably have to arrange a world in which that is the case.
Okay, so no need to apologize because this is fascinating. I want to be clear about something. I'm having you two on as like guests, right? So you don't, it's totally great for you to express your personal opinions on all of these things. So like, don't feel free to just, you know, whatever's in your head on these things. I'd like to spend a little more time there. Like what in your opinion is an alternative arrangement that isn't so Russia-centric, especially because to your point, if you're studying European history at all in the US, you're obviously focusing not even on the French Revolution, it's probably post-1917. So the best case scenario would be you're thinking of, you know, Napoleon and all those things, but you're probably not even there. Like, what are alternative models that could serve as a framework for maybe, you know, Sweden is bigger. Maybe there's a weird Polish-Lithuanian thing again. How should we think about that?
Well, there is a very simple answer to that. Well, maybe it's not that simple, but there is one answer that has already been offered. In 1994, Zbigniew Brzezinski, another statesman, a policymaker of Polish origin, the former national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter, who was born in Poland but spent most of his lifetime in the US, studied at Harvard. In 1994, he wrote a foreign affairs article called The Premature Partnership, where he criticized the policy of the Clinton administration towards Russia as deliberately over-optimistic about Russia's prospects of becoming both a democracy and a responsible partner of the United States in governing the world. And long story short, his counter proposal was geopolitical pluralism, that's how he put it, in the post-Soviet area, in the post-Soviet sphere, which means that, in his belief, the United States should aim to and work to create a post-Soviet sphere in which which doesn't rely on the whims or the attitude of Russia for maintaining geopolitical stability, but instead has all those other countries in those three key regions, Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia, where those other countries, through their own capabilities, strong institutions, stable regimes, but also international partnerships between each other and with the rest of the world, are strong enough to create a stable international equilibrium that fosters growth and peace, even if Russia doesn't like it, so that the West never again has to rely on Russia to be the guarantor and the stabilizer of the post-Soviet sphere. That was his idea, and in my opinion, it's still very relevant.
How about you, Franek?
I can probably quickly add that essentially Russia shoot itself in its foot by the invasion, because they really had a lot of allies in the European Union before the invasion. They had a lot of Russophilic countries. They had a lot of these French people who had these ties to Russia since the 1910s even. And now it's extremely hard to promote pro-Russian views to such an extent that even Marine Le Pen, when she was running for French presidency, she, from what I've read, had to destroy some leaflets featuring herself and Putin, through which she, before the war, she wanted to promote herself as a statesman. So I actually believe in the strength of renewed NATO with new members in the north, and strength of European Union with the renewed sense of purpose.
So next question, let's actually get into the research itself, right? It's a long report. We'll link this in the show notes. There's plenty for people to get into. But I want to just focus on just like the three main takeaways that Axios really pulled, because I think it's a useful way for listeners to really think about. So I just want you two to unpack these three. We'll go by them one by one. So A, Russia's imports have collapsed. What does that mean on the ground, and like what are just the long-term implications of that?
So Russia was dependent on the West because it was mostly exporting commodities, and they needed a lot of exchange parts, turbines. We famously now have this crisis between Germany and Canada about the shipment of the repair turbine to the pipeline. So they were importing all of these advanced technologies, microchips and so on. And now they are facing a 90% cut to these imports in certain instances, for instance, in the instance of cars. So where they've been so dependent on the West when it comes to advanced technologies, that they will very quickly run out of the more advanced parts of the economy. And a very good instance of that already happening are the reports by U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, where she said that on the Ukrainian front, Ukrainian soldiers, after destroying the Russian devices, are finding chips from the dishwashers in the military equipment, because they are trying to repurpose whatever they have to accommodate the new reality. And it's been only 5 months into the war. So year on, they will be starving for anything advanced.
So the next one would be, and actually here's a follow-up question that I'll throw to you, Victor. To what degree is it possible for Russia to, in the long term, be self-sufficient in these technologies, in these developing bits? Because obviously you have autarkic countries like North Korea, but Russia is a much bigger country. Russia does have a real economy. It does have something that the world wants. Like to what degree can Russia insulate itself for the long term, do you think?
Well, there is a historical argument to be made for that proposition, namely the Soviet Union, of course, over 4 years of the Cold War, has been broadly self-sufficient in military technology. They haven't been very good at producing frying pans, but they have produced ballistic missiles very well. And Russia has a lot of resources. So it's not that Russia will not be able to produce anything, but in the long term, of course, if they go for isolation. But some technologies, eventually the Soviet Union has fallen behind the United States and the rest of the developed world, even in high-tech military technology, which is why in the late 1980s, the Soviet Union was struggling to compete in the arms race with the United States. And right now, probably the gap is even larger, because there has been no need over the last decades for Russia to prop up an autarkic military industrial complex. Of course, some degree of mobilization of social resources, of course, at the expense of the consumer, the Russian citizen, will be possible in the long term for Russia to maintain some sort of a military capacity, but it will be significantly less capable than it has been up until now. Maybe they'll get something from China, but nevertheless, the amount of technology that Russia has lost access to will be a major drag. And, you know, as Secretary Austin has said, one of the aims of the United States in this conflict is to make sure that Russia loses the capacity to inflict such a horrible aggression again in the future, in the short-term future. And this starvation of high technology that Russia is inflicting upon itself will be a factor leading to that, probably.
The next claim, then, is that Russia's domestic production has, so separate from the imports, domestic production has come to a standstill. What does that look like and what's driving that?
So certainly a lack of imports is contributing to that, because they've been producing stuff in the lower ranks of the value chain, which were dependent on the parts from the upper ranks of the value chain. So that is one thing. Another thing are capital controls. So they've been propping up the exchange rate of ruble by essentially making it more or less impossible to exchange any ruble to dollars and to, you know, put your assets away from the country. So there are all kinds of obstacles for domestic companies to face, which made it impossible also for them to produce stuff domestically. And I also want to add, when it comes to the future of Russia, that in comparison to North Korea, that we have to remember that North Korea and China were societies which never got this update never got access to you know, Western news sources en masse. And in Russia, this is a different. There is a difference, and it would be perhaps impossible to put that genie back into the bottle to suddenly tell 140 million Russians, a lot of whom like the Western products, a lot of whom send their kids to Western universities, even to Yale. A lot of whom just wanted to have a nice life and overlooked the fact that the thugs are ruling their country. It's no longer possible for them. And I just want to bring up this very interesting statistic that you have no governmental structure besides Putin. Even in China, you have the Communist Party, you have the Shanghai clique, you have the populist faction, you have the Changhua clique. In Russia, you have Putin and essentially nothing else. Putin is 69 already, and the average male expectancy in Russia is 66. So it is really a black box, and a lot of can change in very soon.
Yeah, about the impact that the sanctions have had on the Russian consumer, I want to just quickly jump into that to offer an interesting story. It's not backed with data, but it's backed with real experience. I just returned from Georgia, the country in the Caucasus that borders Russia. That although it is broadly pro-Western, it has a visa-free regime with Russia. So a lot of Russians have often come there for vacation, but especially now, there's been a flood of Russians coming in, a lot of them with big money, who spend their money there because they can't spend it on luxury goods and a nice life at home. And at the same time, there are also people who have fled Russia because of economic constraints. I met people, young Russians who are working as bartenders and waiters because they lost their jobs in Russia, either because their companies, which relied on contacts with the West, could no longer conduct financial transactions with the West, or because those young Russians have participated in protests and have been fired from state-owned companies. And now they have to, those young, educated people, whatever they think about the war, and some of them are actually, most of them are actually avoiding the topic. But nevertheless, you have those young, educated people who have no other choice but to seek their luck elsewhere. And this brain drain is also nothing to be discounted for.
And the final big bit of the takeaways from the research is that the exit of foreign companies accounts for 40% of Russia's GDP. So just explain how that really works, how the effects are, and then just something I'm curious about. I'm sure, you know, lots of people saw this on Twitter, but there was the Russians have taken over the former McDonald's, and I'll have like a Russian-centric knockoff. That's a very straightforward example. How doable is it just to substitute a domestic equivalent for foreign companies that are exiting? You can't do that for Adidas, but you obviously can do that for McDonald's to a certain degree. How should we think about this part of the data set?
Well, you should probably try and Google the pictures and videos of how the McDonald's in Russia, the knockoff McDonald's in Russia is working. They have reported shortages of fries, rotten burger buns, and the overall consumer experience hasn't been particularly stellar, I should say. But that's, of course, anecdotal evidence. But overall, of course, when you have the Russian McDonald's, you have all the infrastructure physically there, and all the people physically there, and most of the supply chains. After all, you don't import burger buns from halfway the world. You can probably produce that in Russia. That's doable. But even with those relatively doable replacements, we have seen that there's been trouble. But as you rightly pointed out, you can't do the same with some stuff that relies on Western technology or design or materials imported from elsewhere, or even labor that has been being outsourced overseas, where those supply chains are no longer in the exclusive control of Russia, but of the foreign companies that have left. So, well, yes, of course, Russians can substitute some of those companies, and they will try. And as we are seeing, in many cases, they're failing miserably. But some of those, especially the more important ones, they're not that easily replaceable.
I think the next question would basically be, and I'm sure this is what everyone is wondering now, what is the end game purpose of these sanctions? Is the objective to punish Russia for invading in the first place? Is the objective to prevent Russia from waging long-term war? You've referenced this. Is the objective to get Russia to pull back to its original borders? How should we think of how long of a sanctions period the broader Western allied plus coalition is signed up for?
Well, the question of what it's is factually is probably a question to the heads of state and government in America and elsewhere in Europe. But in terms of what sanctions are best suited for, is not, of course, to immediately reverse whatever the offending country has done. And then, you know, when most critics, when they criticize sanctions, they pull up this fact that in most cases, sanctions do not immediately reverse aggression or other offenses, but they are meant to severely punish the aggressor, impose costs, and in the long term, make it impossible to continue such an aggression or whatever the country is doing. So, of course, we do not expect that Russia will immediately withdraw because of the sanctions, but the alternative. What is the alternative? We have to ask ourselves the question. Whenever anybody says, oh, but sanctions don't cause immediate reaction, is the alternative of not sanctioning Russia better? Is the alternative of continuing our reliance, our harmful reliance on Russian energy imports that are then weaponized by Russia to harm us politically, truly the better idea? Should there be no costs for actions that, after all, are not just morally wrong, like the invasion of Ukraine and everything, all the horrible war crimes that are going on there, but also positively harmful to our interests? Russians are not just doing something that's morally reprehensible. They are harming our interests, and with the intention of blowing up the Euro-Atlantic alliance. So imposing costs on that is a must. And we prove in this paper, the team led by Professor Sonnenfeld, that the sanctions are effective at imposing this cost, but that doesn't mean one should not take the lack of immediate collapse of Russia and its army as proof that sanctions don't work. It's not that it doesn't work that way.
And Franek, I'd like to throw this to you because I'm curious about this. I feel as if what drove the sanctions don't work conversation is when the sanctions were implemented, everyone was sort of shocked. especially in the media and these different places, it was such a 180 degree turn from the way Europe and the broader Western allied coalition had approached this question. So I saw a bunch of folks. So for example, let's talk about like David Sacks on the All In podcast. I don't know if you guys listen to the All In podcast, but this is a big podcast in the circles that we run in. David is talking about how like, oh my God, the West has dropped this financial nuclear bomb on Russia. This is so powerful. It's too big. This isn't proportionate. That overheated rhetoric happens. And then to your point, Victor, obviously that financial nuke, the financial sanctions weren't going to stop the war on day one. So as it continues, I think people go in the opposite direction and they start saying, oh, well, they don't work at all. So Franek, how do you think about just the, how should listeners who are skeptical of the effectiveness of the sanctions policy, how should they just think about what this is? Is this a nuke? Is it a long-term policy? How should they just be able to conceptualize what we're actually doing here?
So obviously it's hard to function in this very ambiguous space of not black and white, but or different shades of gray. However, probably the best metaphor to use would be to say that this is already constraining Russia from escalating their war, and with each month the cost will increase. So I don't know what's the metaphor you can use here. However, I am not an expert on types of bombs. Maybe one of these jumping bombs. So it like does some damage here and then more damage there and more damage there. But certainly to look at it in the long term. And we perhaps could have another hour about the dynamics of the perception of the war and how it drove the media, how the landscape would be different if the media organizations didn't see the views of particular articles as they did in the past. And now they are tailoring their content to what clicks. And you constantly have this pressure to use this, you know, huge rhetoric to gather as much clicks as you can. So maybe that's one of the reasons why the West was so enthusiastic. That's it.
And to your question of whether or not this is enough, because then the rhetoric swings another way, from too much to not enough, we should consider tightening the sanctions, especially as Russia keeps refusing to back down and keeps upping the ante in terms of how much horrible damage and war crimes it does in Ukraine. For one simple reason, this is the largest international crisis in the last 30 years, and this is the largest challenge to the Euro-Atlantic world conceived in the broadest terms ever since the end of the Cold War. This is almost like a once in a generation crisis. So what we do right now will reverberate for years and perhaps decades to come. When we think of all the other crises and challenges that will face us in the international sphere, all the other possible challenges, our reactions right now will inform the decisions of our adversaries, our friends, our allies for many years to come. So perhaps it is worth to show some more determination and accept some more collateral damage in order to, for those decades to come, build a consensus and a perception that is favorable to us.
Victor and Franek, this has been really great. It's been incredibly helpful. I think this project is hyper useful. I just want to do a quick note for future and listeners who are listening. Obviously, just this is a conversation that's centric about Russia, but there's a bunch of questions that come from this research, this reporting, this scenario. Obviously, it was referenced earlier that the China question is a separate question, but one should be looking at this research and thinking about what the actual broader takeaways are beyond just how companies, individuals, and nations should react. So I think this was very well set up, and thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.